Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Randy's dad was so excited that he could hardly keep his mind on the highway ahead of him. He had just bought what he knew was the most wonderful birthday present his 4-year-old son could imagine, a toy train set. He could just see Randy's face light up watching the locomotive chug around the track, so much like the set he had loved while growing up. That night, after Randy was asleep, his dad worked feverishly to assemble the tracks, hook up the lights, and piece together some of the miniature scenery that came in the set. He stood the box in front of it all with a big ribbon perched on top. The next morning, Randy's dad took his son by the hand and led him to his big birthday surprise. Randy's mouth dropped open as he watched the locomotive and the tiny cars shoot around the tracks, the whistle blowing and the headlights flashing. "See," his dad whispered to his mom, "I told you he'd love it." But after a while, something peculiar happened. Randy got up, clutching his favorite teddy bear, and dragged the big train set box over behind the sofa. Pretty soon he had his whole stuffed animal collection behind the sofa, the train set box positioned like a long fence corralling the animals between it and the big sofa. "Hi, Dad," Randy waved jauntily. "Look at me. I'm driving my own train." From a parent's perspective, what should we know about toys for children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has much experience with children and toys. Dr. Michael Brody is a practicing child psychiatrist and chair of the media committee of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. He is also CEO of the Psychiatric Center in Washington, D.C. Dr. Brody is especially known for his work on connections between television viewing and aggressive behavior in children, and is a strong proponent of children's non-scripted open play. He's the father of 2 grown children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Brody.
Good to be here.
Now, let's talk about toys. What kinds of categories are we including when we talk about toys?
I think the story that Sandy told at the beginning encompasses everything we need to know about toys. Everything. Toys are related to play. That's the issue. And play is very, very important in terms of development. If you watch a child at play, you see that they're developing not only language skills, but motor skills. It promotes development. Now, children use play to overcome certain grievances, to make the unfamiliar familiar, and of course, to rehearse for adult roles. In order to have effective play, you have to have effective toys. And if you watch a child at play, it's often about storytelling. They're telling a story. They're either telling a story to themselves, or when they're playing with other children, there's a story that goes on. So effective toys, essentially, are toys that act as sparks or catalysts for play. In Sandy's story, that box was an excellent catalyst.
Well, isn't it funny that the boxes are often more exciting to children than the actual toys?
Because the open-ended box could be used for many things. It could become a fort, it could become a container, it could become something to hide behind, and so forth and so on.
I remember those trains in our family room, boxes lined up with all kinds of things riding in them. What about the historical significance of toys?
They could trace toys back almost 5,000 years. They have found signs of little implements in caves. Of course, in the Middle Ages, the main people that played with toys were the princes and the princesses. Custom fashion dolls were very, very big, and of course, soldiers. And of course, religious toys, very, very important. Up until the 1800s in our own country, they would have what was called church toys. People would go to church, and then on Sunday, they'd have these Sunday toys that the kids would play with. So they wouldn't be able to play during the week with the toys. They'd only have to play with after church. And one, of course, the favorite toys are toys based on the biblical characters and biblical stories. So a toy like Noah's Ark with all the animals and Noah and his wife and so forth, you know, this was a natural. This was one of the most popular toys. But toys have always reflected what's going on in society. In the early part of last century, with all the building and the technology, we had erector sets. We had the beginning of Lincoln Logs. We had science sets and chemistry sets. Unfortunately now, in the last year or two, a G.I. Joe has made a big comeback, the whole idea of war toys. So in many ways, historically, toys reflect the sociology and the culture of what's going on in society.
Well, that being said, it seems like there are two different kinds of toys that are a big issue right now. The one is the G.I. Joe and the Barbie, which we can talk about, and the other is the emphasis on technology, all the video games and the mechanized toys.
Barbie is made by Mattel. G.I. Joe is made by Hasbro. These are the two largest toy companies in the world. So there's always been this war between these two, in addition to criticism and positive views about these specific toys. Barbie's a very, very interesting toy, and it's a toy that, you know, must be paid attention to since it sells more than $1 billion worth of dolls a year. You know, it keeps Mattel in business and all of her accessories. Barbie is a hybrid toy. Barbie doesn't come with her own script in many ways. She never had her own television program. She has a Nutcracker tape. But when Ruth Handler created Barbie, and she was married to Elliot of Mattel. Mattel was made up of Matthew and Elliot. She was married to Elliot, but she ran Mattel until, unfortunately, she was caught Enronizing, I'll use that term, the financials. But she did invent I Can't Do Math Barbie and Lawyer Barbie. But she had to leave Mattel, and it's pretty interesting what she got involved in. She became one of the largest breast prosthesis makers in the United States. So she went with breasts, whether it was
Barbie
or whatever. And she felt, rightly so, that little girls wanted a fashion doll like a teenage girl. But as I said, the popularity of Barbie, I think, is because it is non-scripted. It is open-ended in many ways. It's more of a hybrid because, again, we know about Barbie's consumerism. Her main importance, other than a lot of people blame the anorexic subculture of young women and the whole thing about the figure and the need to look a certain way on Barbie, her main significance is the fact that Mattel discovered early that you can make Christmas year-round. Christmas was not year-round till the 1950s when they decided to start advertising on television toys. And Barbie was the first toy that was majorly advertised. And it wasn't just a matter of getting a toy for a child for Christmas or for their birthday. It became something that a child had to have. Like most advertising, it created a need.
Isn't that interesting? Now, what about the G.I. Joe figure in comparison to that? Was there the same kind of parallel growth among boys?
Well, it was the same type of from the early 60s, and then you had the situation with the anti-war movement and Vietnam, and G.I. Joe changed their characteristics. It became more of an undercover agent and so forth and so on. But the interesting parallel between G.I. Joe and Barbie is their body type. The body type of G.I. Joe is also criticized because, much like the WWF wrestlers who have their own action figures, they're like masculinity on steroids. You know, the nature of G.I. Joe's body has really undergone amazing changes under the years. And now, at the beginning of certainly the Iraq War and the Gulf War, G.I. Joe comes back with desert paraphernalia, of which there's, of course, criticism.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about toys.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Michael Brody today about toys. Has there been an issue with boys in terms of the body type, eating disorders and things like that, because of these kinds of models?
Oh, girls aren't the only ones that are affected by body type, and especially boys that are reaching, you know, 11, 12 years old, boys and girls going into puberty. At that age, body image is self-image. And boys do look at the way these people look. And, you know, while bodybuilding is healthy, obviously an excess of that and an excess importance of that, and if you are not shaped like that, definitely affects a little boy's self-esteem. And this is why we have some of these tragedies today that are, you know, being brought out more and more about, you know, younger and younger people taking these anabolic steroids, which are incredibly dangerous. Incredibly dangerous. I mean, they promote not only osteoporosis, but cancer as well.
That's really frightening. Yeah. When we look at children by developmental stages, how do we evaluate what toys work best, what first toys we should provide when we are lucky enough to have grandchildren, for example?
One of my patients brought in her two-month-old last night into a group that she used to be in. So there was this two-month-old. And the two-month-old showed again to me what the first toys are of a little infant. My hair, my glasses, the mother's hair, of course, their belly button, their thumb. These are the first toys. And I go back to Sandy's story that the little boy was standing with his favorite stuffed animal. I think she said teddy bear. I think that's what she said. That's a very, very important toy. That special toy, which Winnicott, one of the early child psychiatrists, termed transitional object, is so very, very important. And we've all heard, you know, we're all involved with horror stories about our kids' special toy. Grandma comes, it's all raggedy, it smells worse. She puts it in the washing machine. The smell is very, very important. It reminds me of what some kids do before they go away to college. They may spray their mom's perfume on some of their clothes so they could take that transitional, make that separation to college. And even worse, somebody throws the toy or the toy gets lost. I have a whole collection of stories about people leaving the toy on the plane and the efforts that the airlines have gone through to get the toys back. This is a special priority with airlines because they know the importance of it. And then the kid's about 11 or 12 years old, and they go off to camp, and the parent says, don't take your teddy bear or your baba or whatever. And the lights go out, and all the other kids whip out theirs. And there's your child alone in the dark.
It's,
you know, and when you make college visits, you see all the stuffed animals there. You see. So this is a very special toy, and the meaning of that toy is it's the first time that the kid has to start to learn to deal with their own anxiety. Kids are not fed totally at the right time or changed at the right time, so little babies get anxious, and this soft object helps to relieve their anxiety. That's the nature of the special toy, and the special toy becomes very important. A little bit older, toys that help with what I call ego development, whether it's locomotion or language development, become very important. These are like blocks and crayons, very, very important. And later on, you know, toys that other kids could play with, you know, if you're talking about elementary school age, not just that you could play with. And again, these open-ended toys are the best toys. Farms, forts, toy soldiers, certainly baby dolls and tea sets. These toys have long-standing classical significance.
What about that most expensive of age groups, the middle schoolers? It seems they're particularly susceptible to all the latest electronic gizmos and things.
Yes, but a lot of these things like computers or video games, I don't consider them toys. Again, I think kids do start to play games more at 10 and 11 years old, and unfortunately the toy companies don't promote games like Life or Career. Sometimes they promote Monopoly because of all the different variations, because that's a game where you buy the game and it stays in your house for years, for years. They're not interested in that. They're interested in quick turnover. And certainly these video games for $30 or $40, you know, the kids get tired of them. Get me another video game. But the storytelling that the kids play out should be the kids' own story. These are media stories, and unfortunately, they're not only media stories, they're very violent stories. The object of most video gaming is kills, you know, how many kills you get. And you're using a joystick, so you're using sensory motor parts of yourself to develop these kills. It's not a big secret that the military uses these games as simulation for using real guns. it's kind of upsetting, you know, but the way you win is by killing. And they've done all kinds of research on the aggressiveness that kids feel after they've played these violent video games. They've even done research to show that kids that play a lot of video games aren't the most altruistic of kids. Because in the video game world, it's not good to be altruistic or empathetic. You have to kill that person. There's no thought about who the person is. So these kids tend to give less to classroom charities. They've actually documented that, which I find to be a very interesting statistic. But by no means are these things, you know, videotapes, television, computers, these are not toys. But of course, the Game Boys, which I think Sandy's referring to, they are very, very expensive, as are the video games.
So there's a problem here for parents, because even if you veto these things in your family, your child doesn't play alone at home all the time. Your child goes off to other people's homes where there may be exactly the games you're describing.
Well, I think this is a reality of parenthood. I think a reality of parenthood is the fact, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that our children at some point are going to be out of our sight, that they're going to be in the hands of teachers or coaches, or they're going to be at somebody else's house. The best we could do as parents is provide that space and those objects that are going to promote their development, and also show them by our values what we're interested in and how we control ourselves in terms of what we watch and what we play with.
In a situation like that, how can we insulate our kids against this growing materialism and consumerism to have more of these? And, you know, Johnny has one, why can't I have one?
The kids are literally buried in this junk. And when you watch either network television or cable television, the cable television that the kids watch, like Nickelodeon, I give an assignment to my students about figuring out the number of commercial minutes per hour. There were supposed to be laws about this with the Children's Television Act. But instead of it being 10 minutes or 12 minutes during an hour, it's 17 or 18 minutes. And it's an avalanche. And the commercials do not appeal to adults the way it used to be. They appeal to children. Those commercials go directly to children. And the idea is you're supposed to nag your parent. And there's different ways of nagging. And people have done studies to show there's the sweet nag, there's the aggressive nag, and so forth, to get these particular objects. A very helpful thing, there's two very helpful things that parents could do about this, is one, even at a very young age, children could understand what is meant by media literacy. And media literacy is the understanding that the reason these shows are on is to sell things. And sometimes what they're showing that they're selling is not necessarily what you're going to get. And these things don't last that long. I think another very effective thing that parents could do in terms of this is start early with the concept of an allowance. It's amazing how people are so willing to spend other people's money, like parents, but not so willing to spend their own money. And I think this is a good idea, not only in terms of future development, in terms of budgeting one's resources, which is a real problem with kids that go away to college with credit cards and so forth, the trouble that they get into. But I think it's also a good idea in terms of learning early consumerism.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about toys.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Michael Brody today about toys. Dr. Brody, if you had to give parents a single philosophy about toys to help them through a child's whole growing cycle, what would you suggest?
I would suggest that there has to be this understanding that the idea of toys is to promote play. And the way it promotes play is to get toys that promote storytelling. Open-ended toys are the toys that promote storytelling so the child could tell their own story. When my own older son was about three and a half years old, he was in preschool, and they had a one-way mirror. And I liked you know, would go there to see what's going on. And I was confused, even though I'm a child psychiatrist, and it's so transparent. He and two or three other kids, their whole activity was to take this little baby doll and put the baby doll in the oven. Then they would take the baby doll out of the oven, and they put the doll, baby doll in the oven. It took about three goes of this. I guess I didn't want to see it, to realize he just had a baby brother.
And
this
is the way,
this is the way these kids were working it out. And I asked the nursery school teacher, and I said, those kids that are playing with David, what... She says, I know what you're trying to say. They're all firstborns.
It's nice when it's so obvious.
Oh, it's obvious.
And that they could play it out
at
school.
And they could play it out because they were gaining the control of it. This was their story. They were getting the control of it. Now, again, like with most play, and certainly with teenagers where you want them to verbalize what's bothering them rather than to act out, it's much better for the kid to act this out in play than actually... you know, doing some harm to their sibling. Yes.
Let them act it out.
In their play.
Now, with teenagers, how could they act it out in play?
Well, you want them to be playful with their words, by what they say, in their discussions, in their philosophizing. I think that that's very important. And, of course, you know, in their own sublimations. What I mean by sublimations, their aggressiveness in sports, mm-hmm. their ability to actually act out in acting situations in drama. I think that that's very, very important.
We like to offer our listeners further resources. Where should they go? What can they listen to? What can they read? Are there websites? What about the Toy Fair? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, people are not allowed to go to the toy fair.
Okay.
You have to be a buyer or a seller to go to the toy fair, but there's always a lot written about the toy fair after, and I've been going for the last 5 or 6 years. It's quite interesting because more and more the toys have to be attached to these scripted television programs. At least half the toys now are scripted character toys based on some type of celebrity. And when you go there, you talk to the people who are selling the toys or the people who are even buying the toys. They're not happy. You know, small toy stores continue to go by the wayside. And the problem that they have is they only have a certain amount of shelf space. And if people want a character toy from a television show and it sells, that's what they're forced to do. So little wagons, little trucks, sandboxes, you know, are not, are not the things that are bought or are sold in toy stores. Also, more and more toy stores, Toys R Us aren't the biggest toy seller, which is a surprise, certainly not FAO Schwartz, who filed for bankruptcy last year. The biggest toy sellers, of course, are Walmart. The actual biggest toy distributor in the whole world is McDonald's. They're Happy Meals with their toys. They are the largest toy sellers in the world. So it's very unfortunate to see that kind of thing. Our website at the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, we have stuff written on that. The Campaign for Children, I know it's going to be a new website that's going to be up, which the Academy is sponsoring, is going to have several essays about toys and holiday toys. For a while, I was a consultant to a major toy company because I liked the fact that their baby dolls didn't have their own toy show yet. ZAPFcreation.com. There's a number of essays about toys and the appropriate kind of toys, and these were not edited, so I wasn't just talking about their baby dolls or their little dollhouses, which, again, are excellent toys. But parents should understand that just because it's advertised on television, and just because it brings up, again, going back to Sandy's story, which I think set the tone for this whole program, the fact is, you know, parents want to share what they loved in terms of their generation, and that's another function of toys. That's another function of toys. But perhaps a kid who's 4 years old is too young to appreciate, you know, the train set and the intricacies of this type of thing. It reminds me of going to Disney World. You have all these parents pushing the kids, and the kids don't want to have anything to do with Mickey Mouse or the character. They're afraid of the character. But parents want to share it. They want to share the intergenerational aspects of it.
So it sounds like parents need to be a little proactive in this whole process to get a child a toy that will be open-ended, even if the child wants the thing with the lights and the buzzers. get the toy sandbox, get the toy wagon, get something that has a little bit long-lasting value.
Right. Parents should think about it, and they should never operate, you know, the worst type of parenting, which is, of course, unfortunate in today's day and age, because we're all so busy, and we're running around, and parents, you know, both parents are working. You know, parenting by guilt is a very, very bad idea, and I think what parents tend to do is they're going to buy the kid off, which is just terrible. You know, the kid sees it advertised, but then the kid's dissatisfied. What the kid really wants is the parents. They want to spend the time with the parents. So if it could be a toy, like a block or crayons or Play-Doh, where the parents could actually work with the kid a little bit, I think that those are the best kinds of toys.
Well, you have been the best kind of guest. You have given us a tremendous amount of information.
Always good questions.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Brody, thank you so much for being with us today.
Wonderful to be here.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 203. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.